Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester, his name is John Anilio, and you are listening to episode number 185 of The Functional Nerds. And John?
Yes?
We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them.
All right, I hope that references something later, too. That seems to be, because I have no idea what you're talking about. That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, a podcast dude, a Hugo Award winner for the SF Signal website. You can check out his website, atfmb.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I'm a songwriter and a composer, and you can check out my music over at johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at johnanilio. And today, we are happy to be joined by Brian Stavely. He's the author of The Emperor's Blades, a book out from Tor Books, recently came out. And Brian has taught literature, religion, history, and philosophy, all subjects that influence his novel, and he holds an MA in creative writing from Boston University. He works as an editor for Antelope Press and has published poetry and essays both in print and online. He lives in Vermont, and we are delighted to have him joining us here today. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, Brian came up on my radar because well, as regular listeners of the show will know, you know, that we are lucky and fortunate enough that from doing the show for coming up on 5 years.
Yep.
Are we coming up on 5 years? Wow, crazy. Most of the great genre publishers send us books, and I got Brian's book sent to me, and you know, and there was a pretty good promotion for the book. I would say they gave you a lot of nice attention, Brian, in terms
Tor's
of like
great. Yeah,
trying, everything trying to get the word out about the book. And it is an epic fantasy, and it, you know, caught me as like, yeah, this is one I definitely want to read. And I really enjoyed it, and got to be a little friendly with Brian on the social media, and read his book and loved it, and want to get him on the show to talk about it. So that's why Brian is here today. We'll talk about some other things today too. Brian, you know, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your journey to getting published, because, you know, to get, you know, this is your debut novel, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Have your debut novel published by Tor is a pretty big deal, I would say. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the journey to getting published there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, for many years I taught high school, as you mentioned, and I was tinkering around sort of writing in the summers, but thought I really needed a bigger chunk of time in order to tackle a big project. And so I quit and I moved to Southeast Asia for the year. Just thought I couldn't afford to live in Boston on my savings, but I could afford to live in rural Vietnam and Thailand. And so I went over there and I did a little bit of background research, meaning I counted, I looked at the word count of Game of Thrones and the word count of Eye of the World, and I said, well, I should write a book that's 300,000 words long. So I wrote a book that was 300,000 words long. And then I did a little bit more research and realized, well, shit, that's way too long for a debut novelist, and nobody had any interest in touching it. So then I wrote a shorter book with same world, same characters, but entirely different events. And then people said, well, so that seems a little bit too short. And so then I wrote, you know, a third book, and that one was just right. So that's the short version. But it was really that year away that I got the big chunk of work done on it.
Well, and that's what most people do. You know, they think to themselves, I can't, you know, survive in Boston on my savings, so I'll just move to Vietnam.
Well, I had spent, I know that you guys have had Max Gladstone on the show.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Have talked fondly about Mongolia.
You can't prove that.
I had spent some time in Mongolia earlier, and it really struck me that, you know, you had to eat a lot of bad food and drink fermented mare's milk, but it was very cheap. And that, wow, I could write a lot if I lived over here in Mongolia. And then I kind of started expanding out from Mongolia, looking for other places. So I spent some time in China, Laos, Vietnam, Thailand.
I spent a summer traveling through California when I was in my mid-20s, and I met most of the – because I stayed in youth hostels. A lot of people don't realize that there are youth hostels in the United States too.
Yeah.
Mostly people who don't live in the United States stay in them. But I did because I wanted to sort of spend a whole summer because I'm a teacher. I'm a teacher too, like you were. And so I had the summers off, and I would go out, and I was like, I want to spend the whole summer out here, but I can't stay in hotels all summer. So I stayed in youth hostels. And so I met a lot of people who were from other countries and got to be pretty friendly with some guys from Australia and New Zealand and Canada and England and guys from non-English speaking countries too. Everyone spoke English though, because the rest of the world is so much better than we are.
Exactly.
But a lot of those guys were kind of world travelers, where they did travel through lots of parts of Asia, and that was the thing that they told me. They're like, oh yeah, you could stay in like sort of the equivalent of a 4-star hotel in a lot of these Asian countries for, you know, dollars a day essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
And get a really good meal for very cheap, and so they sort of swore by it. And to me, that sort of blew my mind at age 25, never really having left New Jersey before. I'm like, but you just went to Asia? That's crazy. Like,
right. Yeah. No, it's remarkable. You could stay. What I would do is just go to a country and stay there for a month, because that's usually how long the visa was. And so I'd try and find a nice little guest house, and you could stay at, you could find a really nice, you know, guest house for $5 to $8 a night. And you know, and meals were, you know, quarters. So it was, you know, for me as a single guy who had a few years to build up some savings and, was willing to take the plunge, it was a really good, it was a good strategy. It allowed me to get a lot of work done. And plus, since I didn't know anyone, it was sort of like, oh, maybe I'll go hang out with people. I don't know any people. I guess I'll write another chapter. so that was quite productive.
And how, sort of technologically speaking, you know, did you have internet access? Did you like, or was it just basically you and the laptop and writing away?
Pretty much me and the laptop. Yeah. You know, you could usually find a cafe where you could get online, and I would use that to, you know, touch base with friends and family back home. But it was awesome not to have the internet, just because the internet is my nemesis.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet is what now tries to keep me from writing the third book. You know, I'll be writing away and the internet whispers to me, hey, Brian, come on, stop writing for a minute. Just look at this article about whatever thing. And then an hour later, I realize I've wasted an hour.
Yeah, I actually blame Google News.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there are all sorts of culprits that lead me astray, that, you know, I just go down the rabbit hole.
Google News and SF Signal. Those two bastards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I notice what I try to do with because I am pretty active on social media, and I try to keep up with the blogs that I like. And what I found what works for me is, in terms of social media, and I've talked about it on the show before, I use a thing called Buffer, which lets you sort of schedule things throughout the day. So I'm not on it all day. I post things, but I have a couple times a day that I actually go on and I talk to people and do some things. But I try to just like sort of set time, do it for that set time, and then get off. Because like you said, it's so easy just to be like, oh, I'll just, you know, I'll look at it for 10 minutes. And then the next thing you know, a half hour went by and you're
right,
like, I could have actually done something. I could have kept working on a song, or I could have wrote a blog, and like, I just looked at Twitter for a half hour. And then you get kind of grumpy and angry. And
I feel bad about myself.
Me too. Yeah.
You go, oh man, I had to click that link talking about how Seth Rogen smoked pot with Snoop Dogg.
I did click that exact link.
I know.
Link.
I did. Shut up.
It didn't give me the list of celebrities I was expecting to see.
No, so, it was just like a couple.
Not only did I click the link and waste time, but I didn't even find what I was looking for. I'm glad to know I wasn't the only one.
Uh-uh. Yeah. So I find if I just sort of set times for myself, and what I also try to do is try to make sure I get like my creative work in before I even look at it. So I barely ever look at that. I used to look at that in the morning, like first thing.
Yeah.
And like now I don't at all. Like I don't touch it until at least lunchtime, because I'm just like, because I want to actually feel good about myself and make sure that I got some work in first, and then we can look at that later. And it's still going to be there at noon. Whatever was there at 8:30 in the morning is going to be there at noon.
It sounds like you have this awesome thing that I've heard of called discipline, and still looking into that. Haven't seemed to acquire it yet.
It just comes from time.
And if you grew up going to Catholic school, you know, they bred that discipline into you, and so now you rebel.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, you know, I went to Catholic school too, but my discipline actually really comes from I played football and I wrestled in high school. Yeah. And that's where it kind of comes from. Even though I'm not athletic in any way to this day, that really got me to sort of be disciplined, because you can't really do anything. Because the coaches just make you be disciplined. I think it's a good thing for a teenage boy to be involved in stuff like that. Kind of helps you get your crap together a little bit.
Now I'm seeing a way for like Catholic parishes to make money. They just basically send nuns to the houses of former Catholic school students to stand there and stare at you and make you do the work.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a Catholic school student, but I'm sure if there was a nun standing at each shoulder, I would
That'll be able anybody.
To. Yeah, and then you'd say, well, Sister Mary Clarence, I'm sorry, I have to look up I have to do some research for this scene I'm writing about, it's kind of about some kind of crazy sexual stuff, so please don't look at my computer screen right
now. Just bear with me for a second, Sister, just bear with me.
So anyways, you know, and you're a dad now too, Brian.
I am. Yeah, I have 2-year-old.
So, you know, my son's 7, and taking care of kids helps you to be disciplined, because a lot of that time that used to be your creative time is time taking care of your kids, you know. So it's you learn to have to be creative in making that time for yourself. So that's where you have to sort of become disciplined, because otherwise it's so easy to just put it off to the side and put it off to the side, and then so there you go. But anyway, all right, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And, you know, I'm going to go first this week. I'm actually going to pick a record label that I've seemed to be listening to a lot of artists on this record label. It is called Frontiers Records. And as people who listen to the show know, I like all kinds of music, but there is still a soft spot in my heart for a lot of the 80s metal that I grew up listening. And I still like a lot of that stuff. And a lot of those bands, believe it or not, still put albums out. Most of you would have never heard of them because they're on this small label called Frontiers Record. And Frontiers Records is owned and operated by this Italian guy, like this guy that lives in Italy, Italian, like Serafino something. I don't know think of his name. But so, you know, if you want to find the latest albums by like Whitesnake and Journey and Extreme and all this kind of stuff, they're on this label. But what's really cool, I take cool with a grain of salt. you may not find it to be so cool, but is that this guy just loves that kind of poppy metal kind of stuff that all of these new bands that you've never heard of are signed to it. And there's this band, and a lot of them are European bands, so they're, you know, Norwegian and Italian and German and English and, you know, some American bands too, but all of this stuff is sort of made and recorded either in home studios or in these big studios in Italy, and all of it's good. I've liked everything that I've heard, and it's all these bands that I've never heard of. All these albums have been put out in the past like 3 or 4 years, which I think is kind of crazy. But I do use Spotify, and all of these albums are up on Spotify because Frontiers puts their stuff up there. So just, you know, do a Google search for Frontiers Records. You'll find their sort of roster of artists. You'll see a lot of names you know, and you see a lot of names you don't know. And then go over to Spotify or what have you and put those names you don't know. And if you like that sort of pop metal thing, you will find a lot of music that you'll like. So that is my pick this week, Frontiers Records. Brian, what is your pick this week?
Well, maybe I'll have two. They're both books. One's a new book and one's an old book. The new book is The Martian by Andy Weir, which has been getting a lot of buzz.
Yeah.
And long story short, on the first page, the narrator is on Mars and he's been abandoned by the rest of his crew who think he's dead. And then for the rest of the book, he tries to survive. And it's one of those books, if I were the main character, I would have been dead by page 2. And if any of my friends were the main characters, they would have been dead by pages 3 through 6. So it's really cool to kind of read about how resourceful and ingenious this guy is in doing everything from rewiring the electronics to do the things that he needs them to do to growing potatoes and figuring out how to get soil that will actually support potatoes so that he can survive and not starve. I read it in, you know, a day and a half. It reads really fast, and it's just a delightful book. The other book that I've been reading at the same time, which is sort of an odd counterpoint, is Ursula Le Guin's book, The Farthest Shore, which was the third of her Earthsea trilogy. And I read them when I was a kid, and I was looking, they're sort of, they were marketed at the time as kids' book, but they are not kids' books. That book, if I ever need reminding, reminds me that she is just at the absolute top of the fantasy pantheon. It sometimes irritates me that everybody sort of nods to Tolkien and either says, well, I like Tolkien or I don't like Tolkien, but of course Tolkien. And I think that, I mean, I like him too, but I think that Ursula Le Guin is just a staggeringly good writer. And so going back to that book has been really enjoyable.
Very cool. You know, and I've been reading nothing but good reviews about that Andy Weir book. That seems to be popping up. Although I know John DiNardo at SF Signal gave it a nice review. I think, did Andrew Liptak review that somewhere too?
He read it recently, and he really enjoyed it. I was chatting.
I feel like he was tweeting about that or something too. So very cool. I'm going to have to check that out. And you know, Ursula Le Guin is one of those people that shamefully I have not read, and it's on those classic authors that you have to go and read, and so I still have to get to that.
Well, the nice thing about the Earthsea books is they're short, you know, they're these slim little volumes, very modest, but just brilliant.
Cool. Well, I will have to pick up a couple of those because I'm down with that for sure. Cool. All right. So those are Brian's picks. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
Well, before I get to my pick, I did want to mention Brian is published through Tor, and one of his Tor book buddies would then be Sanderson, and Tor sent me Sanderson's latest book. And you were talking about your book being like your first draft was like 300,000 words. Anyway, they sent me a review copy of Sanderson's newest book, and I had to get a forklift to get it into the house.
Yeah, that thing is big.
I placed it on my glass table, and of course it destroyed it and pushed it through the floor and down into the basement. So yeah, I don't know if I'm going to be actually picking that book up, but I do have it. But no, hey, my pick is going to be Netflix, because they are showing now Star Wars The Clone Wars.
Oh, yeah.
And they are including the quote-unquote Lost Missions, which is the last season that we didn't get to see on Cartoon Network, because when Disney bought the world, when Disney bought LucasArts, they actually got the rights to it, and they immediately canceled The Clone Wars on Cartoon Network and said they weren't going to show it there anymore. So originally, the only way to get the Lost Missions was to be in Germany and watch it on a specific station that had some weird contract clause or something. But now we're going to actually get to see it on Netflix. So I've been kind of binging through the Clone Wars here recently.
Yeah, I've never seen it, and I've been wanting to watch it for a while. How do you like it so far?
Oh, I love The Clone Wars. I was watching it every week when it was on Cartoon Network. It was really well done. In the very beginning, there's some cheesy moments. Like they overdo how stupid the droids are, like the droid army.
Okay.
And you know, I mean, the droid army, as they are even in the movies, you can walk up to one and just kind of flick it on the nose and it'll fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still the same in the Clone Wars. You know, they shoot them one time and they just fall apart.
Yeah.
But it got a lot better as time went on, and they got a little bit darker. They went into some of the, you know, Anakin. And the whole thing that's kind of is like an overarching thing on here is Anakin Skywalker is given a Padawan, and you know at some point he is going to slaughter her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you're just kind of thinking this whole time, oh, they're such good friends, and oh, he takes care of her, and oh, he really likes her, and he does all this stuff. And in the back of your mind going, yeah, but he's going to slaughter her along with all the rest of the Jedi. You know it's coming. You know it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, it's something I've been meaning to watch. And then to sort of pick up on what you were saying about the Brandon Sanderson novel, I got that sent to me too. And I read book one, and I loved book one. I can't wait to tear into book two of that. I actually bought the ebook last night because, I mean, I read everything on ebook anyway these days. So, you know, I have Brian's hardcover too. And Brian's is, you know, a modest like 480 pages, as opposed to the 1,100 pages that Words of Radiance is. But Yeah, I had to go out and buy the Words of Radius because there's no way I was lugging that thing around. Because I read it like the gym and at lunch and all that kind of stuff. It's just
I admire him. I really do. I admire his ability to write. The book is probably wonderful. You could get four of them and put a car up on blocks. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's tons of uses for such a huge volume.
Yeah.
Killing very small rodents.
It is
crushing
it is
dictators in
long.
Foreign countries.
How much did the first book stand alone? I haven't read it, and partly it's because I don't want to get to some cliffhanger ending after 1,000 pages and then
I read book one, and I think it stands alone as a novel in its own merits.
Okay.
Quite nice. I think there's a nice resolution. There's a nice characters coming together.
Yeah.
I think it's just fine on its own.
Okay, that's good to hear.
It doesn't fall off a cliff.
At the end, when the characters come together, is there a song where like these little guys are going yub yub, da-da, yub yub, da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da? No.
No, nothing like that. No celebratory singing, but
no one playing drums on helmets.
No, unless that was off page. I didn't. Yeah, but anyway, so there, so cool. So Patrick's Clone Wars and comically large books from Tor. So speaking of large books from Tor, let's talk a little bit about Brian's book, the Emperor's Blades. I did just finish reading it, and I really, really liked it a lot. We talked a few things about the book, Brian. I liked so much about it, and the thing that really resonated with me was how you kind of with and if I'm pronouncing the characters' names wrong, please.
Sure. Yeah.
Please correct me. But Caden and Valen, to the two brothers in this story, how they each go on their own hero's journey. Basically, I, at least that's the way that I interpreted it. There was
sure.
a lot because I think that's I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell, and I just really love that whole idea. So, and I've read a couple of books on it, and as I was reading your book, you know, there's a lot of that in there. Not apparent, but just, you know, it's like, oh yeah, there you go. I just got a copy of The Emperor's Blades right there, and it's really, you know. I don't recall reading another book where there's sort of like a dual hero's journey, which really it is kind of what it is. So I don't know if that was by design from the beginning or if it just ended up that way. So how did that come about for you? Was that intentional to do it that way?
I guess it partly intentional and partly subliminal. I read a lot of Joseph Campbell when I was younger and was just blown away by his stuff, The Power of Myth and those books. But then I haven't really paid much attention to him in, I don't know, 15 years or something. But I think that you read enough fantasy and you study enough religion and mythology, and a lot of that stuff just becomes part of your writing subconscious. It just seeps into your DNA. And I like coming of age stories, and I like training stories. Mm-hmm. For all three siblings, really, we see them at a crucial point in their development. And I think of, in a quick and dirty way, I think of them as having slightly overlapping areas of expertise or mastery. Caden really has been working on his emotional control, his emotional and psychological mastery. And that's an area where neither Valen nor Adair is particularly adept. Valen, of course, has more practical, real-world skills, especially physical skills. And Adair, I think, is the smartest of the three. Mm-hmm. One of the problems of the first book and of the series in general is that Caden is slated to be emperor, but he'll make a pretty shitty emperor. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know anything. He has no sort of book learning, and for all of his emotional control, he doesn't have the skills necessary to rule this massive polity. Whereas Adair has those skills, but both she and Valen maybe lack some of the emotional control necessary to employ the skills. So I enjoyed throwing challenges at those three characters that were challenges for them. And so when Caden, around the middle of the book, they all you know, there's sort of a mini climax about halfway through for all of them. And the things that are difficult for Caden maybe would have been easier for Valen and vice versa. So it's the trick is finding a way to challenge each character on his or her own turf, you know, give them something that's demanding for them. And so it was fun to kind of see them as a counterpoint or a little harmony to each other.
Yeah, I, you know, and one of the things that I really enjoyed the most where it is, you know, and I'm kind of guessing that this comes from maybe some of your time that you spent in Asia and maybe some of your study of various religions, but, you know, Caden is studying with monks.
Yeah.
in a you know, sort of, you know, Zen kind of a Buddhist kind of place. And,
sure.
You know, I was always very interested in that. You know, we joked around about Catholic school earlier, and I'd read a lot of Buddhism books at one point in my life, in my sort of late teens and early 20s, and you know, I never really could get my head around the whole, you know, meditating, and you know, it just I wanted to, you know, but I think as a Westerner, it's very difficult to bend your head around that. And what I loved, and I won't mention it in any spoilers, is what Brian does with sort of meditating and sort of reaching this higher state of consciousness and calm. There's a very practical application to why that's what you know these monks are trying to achieve. It has a very sort of action oriented thing, and when you reveal that in the book, I'm like, that makes sense. Now I want to learn how to meditate. You know, so it really, to me, I loved that aspect of it. And I don't, and again, so what were through your own background with that in study where you sort of made it sort of so practical like that? Is there any sort of real world analog to that?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I didn't know. So in my teaching job, my background was all in English. And so I was hired to teach English, but they didn't have a full position in English. And so they said, well, can you teach this other class of history? And because I wanted the job, I said, yeah, I can do that. And I didn't know shit about history I was supposed to be teaching. So I spent a very busy summer reading furiously so that I could teach that history course, which was a great experience because it meant that then I felt as though I could teach any courses as long as I had a summer to prepare. And that's how I ended up in teaching world religion, a subject, again, that I knew almost nothing about before I started teaching it. And particularly, I knew nothing about Taoism or Buddhism. And my vague understanding of Buddhism, based on my experience growing up in New England, was that it was kind of a touchy-feely thing that overlaps significantly with yoga and being gluten-free and, you know, just kind of a set of beliefs, like maybe you drove a Prius and that was Buddhism. And I was really struck as I started to dig into the religion and studying it, that it ended up seeming to me, at least the early incarnations of Buddhism, the more philosophical Buddhism, as being the most hard-headed and practical of all of the faiths that I was dealing with. Specifically, you know, there's a great precept. Buddha, people are always trying to get him to opine on these sort of metaphysical matters, the nature of gods or the afterlife, etc. And he didn't so much say, he wouldn't talk about those things. And he would say, I'm here just to talk about suffering and the ending of suffering. And he said, imagine that you have an arrow stuck in your flesh. That's the situation we're all in. We are all suffering. And you're asking all these questions like, who shot the arrow and what kind of wood is the arrow made out of? And hey, look at this fletching. What kind of bird is that from? He says, those questions have answers, but the real urgent thing is getting the arrow out of your chest. And that's the thing that I'm aiming at. And that hard-headed practicality really struck me, especially since it was so at odds with what I had ignorantly believed about Buddhism before that. So I wanted the monks, and especially the more adept monks, to have that edge to them. They wanted them to be very grounded and very sort of results oriented. They don't have their head in the clouds, really, even though that's the way it looks to, you know, the people who haven't studied there. Valen and Adair are always thinking, oh, what the hell is Caden learning? What is he doing up there? Mm-hmm. And even Caden sometimes thinks that because he doesn't fully understand it. But there is an answer to that question, mm-hmm. and a very practical answer.
Yeah, and a very satisfying answer, because that's when it really hit home for me. I was enjoying the book just fine up until that point, and I'm not sure when it is in the book, a couple hundred pages in, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
I just felt like, oh yeah, that was mm-hmm. like that. Oh, now this is, and then sort of the other side of that coin is Valen's sort of military training that he is going through, mm-hmm. and it, you know, did you have a particular model for the, now again, if I'm pronouncing it wrong, for the Ketrel, the Ketrel?
Yeah, the Ketrel, yeah, Ketrel.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any sort of real world analog to them as well?
Well, I like reading sort of military history and specifically special forces stories. Mm-hmm. I just find those interesting and engaging. And it struck me that I hadn't seen before in a fantasy, the fantasy analog of modern special forces. You mm-hmm. have knights, and fantasy is replete with elite warriors, right? But that kind of modern small team unit that mm-hmm. is mainly not used to fight pitched battles, but to drop in behind enemy lines and carry out covert missions. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen anything quite like that. And I thought, wow, that's really something that I could do that would be a little bit new in the genre. Mm-hmm. And so the Ketrel, they fly into battle, for people who haven't read the book, on these massive birds. And mm-hmm. I just needed helicopters. Mm-hmm. And so though they are the helicopters of the Ketrel, and of course they're, I think, more interesting.
The eagles are coming. The eagles are coming.
Yes. They have minds of their own, and they play a role. But I was interested in having sort of modern special mm-hmm. forces in a fantasy novel. And so they all have specialties. You know, there's the sniper and demolition people and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, and I love that, and that's why I really enjoyed it in terms of, like, you know, having a more than one kind of hero's journey, because Valen goes on his journey mm-hmm. with his military training, and Caden goes on his journey with his sort of monk philosophical training, and they sort of played great off of each other, and mm-hmm. And then there now. This is what, you know, what I do want to ask you with this is because, you know, you talk about how you had a much longer version of this.
Yep.
So, and I know there's going to be more volumes coming. So in book two or book three, is there going to be more from Adair's point of view?
Way more.
Yeah. That's what I kind of think, because when I was reading it, and I did read a couple of reviews of the book that were like, oh, I wish there was more Adair in this. And I'm thinking mm-hmm. like, I bet this was longer, and I bet there was more Adair in it, and we're waiting on more Adair for book two. That's so I don't know if I'm wrong in my assumption of that, but that's kind of what I was guessing, is that we're going to get a lot more of her coming soon.
You're dead on. Yeah.
Yeah.
The real question was whether to include her in the first book at all. Not because I didn't have a lot of material for her, but I thought if she can't have equal pages with the brothers, maybe it's best just to leave her out entirely and then give her all of book two. Mm-hmm. That was one possibility, mm-hmm. have the first book be about the brothers and the second book be about Adair. But I, in the end, decided not to do that, and I decided not to leave her out entirely because I really wanted her to hit the ground running in book mm-hmm. two. I thought it would be a little bit awkward if we had to... There's a pacing and a tone when you're introducing characters for the first time that works well in the first book of a series and seems a little bit kludgy, I think, if you encounter it in book two or three. And so I wanted her to really be ready to go. And I'm sympathetic with readers who say, hey, I wish there had been more Adair. Why isn't she there? I wish she was there too. And she's really central to book two. Tor US has released the cover for book two already, the cover art, and you can see it on my website. And it's a big, you know, Adair is front and center, holding up a spear that's being struck by lightning, which happens in a central scene in the book. So there's a lot more of her. She's centrally located geographically, but she's also really central plot and thematically in book two. And there's also a fourth, a new POV character in the second book, somebody that you already know, but who is not a POV character in book one. So,
cool. I look forward to that very much. And I like the way that you handled it in terms of that, because I think Adair, because like I said, Caden and Valen are going on their own journeys that are mm-hmm. pretty much removed from the political things that mm-hmm. are going on in the world, and Adair is there to sort of sort of show what is becoming of the world that they live in and
right.
what they're sort of training for. So I think you kind of need that. I enjoyed the balance like that. I thought it was just fine.
I thought she needed to be in there for her own reasons and so the reader could see Anur, you know, see the capital city. And I, you know, I didn't want to put her in if she couldn't have a complete plot arc. Mm-hmm. And although she has fewer pages dramatically than Caden and Balin in book one, I think she does have a whole arc, mm-hmm. you know, around unmasking her father's killer. Mm-hmm. So I was satisfied with that narrative, even if I would have liked for her to have more scope.
Cool. Now, when does book two come out? When is that set to come out?
January.
Sweet. Cool. All right. Well, very good. So let us begin wrapping it up. Brian, so you have your website, which is it just brianstavely.com?
Bstavely.wordpress.com.
Okay, very good. And you're on the Twitter, and what's your Twitter handle so people can check you out there?
At Brian Stavely. And my last name has two E's, Staveley.
Very good. And do you have any upcoming con appearances that you would like to let our listeners know about?
Let's see. I'll be at ReaderCon this summer, and I'll also be at DragonCon. And I may be at World Fantasy Con. I haven't decided on that yet. So
Cool. I've been to ReaderCon before. I like that one very much. That's a great, as the name implies, it's a great genre literature-focused con. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of people run around in costumes there, but if you're into the literature part of it, it's definitely one worth going to. And a World Fantasy is in D.C. this year, I think. So right. That's one being in New Jersey I have on my radar of possibly going to as well.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. For me this week, you can just check out my music over at johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. And Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Usual stuff. Go over to SF Signal. Check out the podcast there. Check out atfmb.com. I'm also atfmb on Twitter and Facebook. I will be at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference April 25th to 27th. I'm on the faculty. I'll be doing a panel and some other stuff there. So if you're a writer and you're looking to meet editors and agents and talk to other writers, it's not really a fan con. It's a convention. It's not really a convention. It's a conference. So mm-hmm. if you're interested, you know, take a look at that. Pikes Peak Writers. And Locust. I still want to mention that because if you've gotten the latest issue of Locust, they did a nice little piece on SF Signal, and John and JP and I are on there. And I thought that was really nice of them, and I appreciate them doing that.
Very, very good. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.